Mark and Becky, you can tell Erin someday that on the day of her baptism, one of her irrepressible Irish kinfolk wore a green hat. I'm particularly pleased to see a paternal grandparent, Bill Cummings, because Bill and I have been in class together this semester. He is auditing a course called Themes and Ideas in American Literature. And since Mary is not present, I will say that he has utterly charmed the young ladies who sit around him. There are certain people you do not expect to do much praying. When the drug smuggler from South America was pushed into a cell, the angry jailer said, "All you've got left, brother, is a prayer." Humbled, for the moment at least, the narcotics king replied, "Then I'm out of luck. I don't know how to pray." We're not surprised. Nor when the indicted mafia chieftain says, "Forget prayer. Get me a good lawyer. I haven't prayed since I was six." We would not have expected him to know how to pray. But it really comes as a shock to hear the Apostle Paul, halfway through his letter to the Roman church, say that he doesn't know how to pray. In fact, it's surprising to hear this man say that there is anything he doesn't know. In most of his writings, he is the most confident man you would ever hope to meet. Put him in a debate with some of his former Jewish classmates, and he says, "We know that the law is good," and then he boldly puts Christianity in its place. Put him in a pulpit, and he says, "We know that all things work together for good to those that love God." Put him at a table with strange food that he as a Jew has never eaten, and he says, "We know that nothing is unclean in itself except to one who thinks so." Put him in jail, and he says, "I know in the Lord that I'll be set free to come to you." Lead him up to his own grave, and he says, "We know that if this earthly tabernacle be dissolved, we have a house eternal, not made with hands." Paul is never timid and seldom uncertain. He knows. But bring him into the chapel, alone, at the altar, and suddenly he says to us, "We don't know how to pray." Why would he say that? This man who prayed constantly and who asked all the churches to join him in prayer. Why would he say, "We don't know how to pray"? If you know, please tell me, because I don't. Preachers have a way of asking questions they intend to answer, but I'm not doing that. My guess would be that Paul has entered so deeply into the spirit of prayer, of communion with God, that words have become crippled and inadequate for his feelings. A little later in that same letter, he says, "Oh, the depth of wisdom and knowledge in God, how unsearchable his judgments, how untraceable his ways, who knows the mind of the Lord. So it could be that this great apostle is simply saying, in the final analysis, I don't know the will of God, and so I don't know how to pray. Or maybe it's the mystery of his own life that paralyzes him sometimes when he wants to pray. I know that he was really puzzled at times, failing to do what he really wanted to do, doing things at times he absolutely hated, until he cried out that he was wretched in all those tangled ropes of motive. How much of him, he must have wondered at times, was what he had created, and how much was freight that had come with him out of childhood? How much of our own doing is what we are? I'm always surprised by the things my own children picked up unconsciously and now think they invented for themselves. Tricks of speech, ways of thinking, eating habits. I heard one of my sons singing a song one day that didn't sound likely for him. It's a song that goes, I give to you and you give to me true love. I hope you recognize it. I considered singing it and reconsidered. But I said when I heard that, where in the world did that come from? He looked surprised and said, I don't know. And then I remembered. Billy sang that song by the hour as she rocked him when he was a baby. Not because she liked it particularly, but because he did, and asked her to sing it over and over, and you need something to help pass the time when it's 1:30 in the morning and your child has colic. How much else is in him because of her and me and his brothers and sisters and all his friends? We love to say we make our own choices. We love to say we are objective about things. But an enormous amount of what we are has been put into us before we were grown. So Paul has some problems with prayer. And who knows how much is due to that incredible mix we call personality. Maybe Paul sees all of us as adults whose minds are so cluttered with trivia that we don't know how to pray because prayer is serious. I watch children come into the convenience store and load up on the most incredible junk food. I ask myself, how can that child ever be brought to want to eat fruit and fiber? We stuff our heads with idle chatter and stock prices and changes in fashion. How can we ask for what we need when we're so full of what we want? We don't know how to pray. Paul had gotten busier and busier. It may have been hard even for him to find the time for prayer. My niece writes to me that her husband is working from 5:30 in the morning until 10, 11, and 12 at night. 6 open heart surgeries in the last few days, she said. She doesn't see much of him. But his plan, she explained, is to make a great deal of money quickly and then retire young. The last time I saw him, he believed very much in prayer. He may not have time for it now. Is it possible Paul is saying, I don't know how to pray for the people I love? Do you know that dilemma? Have you sat across the hall from surgery, waiting, wondering how to pray, how to know what it would be best to ask for? Or you look at the children and you know what you want for them, but if you go so far as to pray, you begin to wonder whether what you want is best, and sometimes the words die on your lips. I think in this letter to Rome, Paul may be recognizing that sometimes, in some awful moment in the presence of God, the best thing you can do is shut up. Fall silent. I know he did that once when he took up money for the poor disciples in Jerusalem and was deeply grateful for the way people had helped, and then said finally, thanks be to God for his inexpressible gift. In other words, I don't know how to say it. I don't have the words. And once, talking about a vision he had, he says he heard words that were unlawful to utter. He can't say them. He'd like to boast a little, but his lips are stopped. Is he trying to tell us that when we really get to the point of what prayer is, we stop chattering and the words get slow and painful, or else they won't even come to fit our feelings? Prayer never can be easy. That's a contradiction in terms. If a prayer goes too fast, too glibly, too easily, something is wrong. Somebody has built a prayer out of the kind of chatter that passes for conversation. I have taught essays now and then written by a Kiowa Indian named Scott Momaday. And in one of them is a story that tells how he learned the difference between the casual and the critical. As an Indian, Scott was made fun of sometimes in school. But when he went to his grandmother's house, she would always give him comfort. Her kitchen, he says, was an arsenal of good food, and her apron was my fortress. She would put salve on a scraped knee, wipe my tears, and seat me at the table in front of jam and bread and milk. One day, he says, he came in yelling for her, Grandma. No response. So he walked on into her little bedroom and stopped dead in his tracks. She was kneeling by the bed, her normally braided hair loose over her copper skin, praying in her native tongue, with her arms rising and falling as her custom was. And he said, I was so frightened that I did not say a word. All I know is that I backed out of that room because I had no right to be there. That prayer was serious. It was a fine insight for a boy that at times you just don't say anything. Paul had learned that, but there were times when he felt frustration. because he could not speak when he wished to speak. I don't know how to pray. It's too bad. He couldn't write in for $10 worth of tapes that tell people how to pray and guarantee results. He could never have guessed that one day in a place called the United States it would be possible to hear people talk about prayer as part of a success story. Like this one, the other night. My husband and I were just getting nowhere. We were stuck at $50,000 a year. And then I took it to Jesus in prayer. And last year we cleared over $100,000. We moved to a new part of town. We have lots of new friends now. Business is booming. Praise the Lord. Poor Paul, who didn't know how to pray. He had no idea, for example, how practical prayer can be. There was the woman about to leave on vacation who testified in church that she was embarrassed about her luggage. So she prayed. Then she got new luggage. One of the children sent it as a gift, but she was sure the prompting had come from God, who was not too busy to worry about her luggage. Not too busy with all the world's heartache and poverty and pain to order up a matching set for her. And there was the woman who said she left her ironing to go to a downtown store, and on the way she began to wonder whether she had turned off the iron. I didn't want to go back, she said, so I just prayed, Jesus, turn off that iron. And was it turned off? Somebody asked. And she said happily, yeah. And there was the spa in Atlanta that advertised that you could have the figure Jesus wanted you to have. And that one woman had already prayed off 40 pounds. How strange. It all sounds this success story kind of prayer. This give me what I want kind of prayer. When you hear the Apostle Paul agonizing over the fact that he doesn't even know how to pray. This great Christian who influenced the way the church would think more than any other man in the first century. He had some affliction. Worse than bad luggage, I think. Worse than the iron being left on. Worse than being overweight. It was something so dreadful that it handicapped his ministry and caused people to shun him. He called it his thorn in the flesh. And he prayed over and over in deep earnest that it might be taken away. Surely, he must have said to God, please, get rid of this thing. Just think what I could do for you if I were well. But nothing happened. And Paul understood that the answer had to be, no, Paul, my strength is sufficient. Just carry on as you are. But you don't hear about that kind of rejection at a 20th century success-oriented prayer testimonial. And apparently Jesus did not know how to pray either. In Gethsemane, talking to God for hours, sweating in his anxiety and asking urgently, is there some way I can avoid this terrible way of dying? Can you do something? Will you? And finally, All right. Not my will, but thine. It doesn't sound like the woman who got the luggage, the one whose iron was turned off, the one who prayed off the pounds. In fact, the prayer of Jesus stopped being a request and became submission. What a world of difference. He needed someone to teach him how to use prayer in the 20th century way. My guess would be that in the garden, most of the prayer that Jesus prayed was silence. And filling the silence, his deep sorrow over what seemed to be a failed mission, his dread for what was about to happen to him, his concern for how he would respond to it in a way that would inspire his friends and not dismay them and disappoint them forever. Maybe it's just as well we don't know that prayer, the one that went up without words, in silence. It might be unbearable. So Paul says, we don't know how to pray. The words won't come right. The room is full of silence. But after all, he said, even then, we're actually praying. In those agonizing longings, which never find words, the Spirit of God speaks for us. And God hears the words we couldn't find. That was a great comfort to Paul. And I offer it to you as comfort. In those times when there are no words to speak your pain, your doubt, your confusion and loneliness. A minister I know tells about one of those wordless prayers when, as Paul put it, we have groanings that cannot be uttered. He lived in Anadarko, Oklahoma, where there was an Arapaho Cheyenne Indian woman who wrote a weekly column in broken English in the newspaper. Her name was Molly Shepherd. And my friend came to love her as he read what she would say about her people, about tribal dances and powwows and who was sick and who was helping. He said he didn't like much else in that little paper, but he kept buying it so he could read what Molly said. And then one day, on the Friday after the death of President John Kennedy, he turned to read her column, and this is what he found. Molly has no article today. Molly has nothing to say today. Molly has no words today. All week, Molly goes through the house saying, oh, oh. What else was there to say? In that simple, kind-hearted woman, a prayer went up to God in the shape of a sorrow that could not be spoken. And sometimes it will happen to you. Don't be dismayed if you cannot find the words. The best prayer of all may be silence.